session number 19089, Reel 6.
Reel 6, Stephen Kennedy.
On the end of embarkation leave, we had a letter telling us to report to reception centre at Leon Sea in Essex. And after a long journey back, we got to Leon Sea, and there was a number of my friends there from the regiment and people I'd met on the ship coming over. And as we arrived, there were officers from all the other regiments that were due to go on the invasion, and they were touting for the various chaps that had just come back and done their 6 years in the Middle East to come and join them in their regiment. It was the 5th Tanks and other regiment, cavalry regiment, wanting to get you. But I had this War Department posting, and I just showed it to them, and they let me alone. But anyhow, this Leon Sea was a really nice suburban area of houses, semi-detached houses, something similar to this, taken over completely, and all the residents were moved out. And the main problem was that during that time, the Luftwaffe were bombing London Estuary, and we were right just down below us was all these docks where they were building these landing craft, and the bombers used to come over every night bombing them. And fortunately, they didn't know that we were in these residential area, and we got missed. But that's from there then I got sent to Lulworth. And at Lulworth, first of all, I did a refresher course there, and then I went on to a map reading course and a compass correction course. Now, they had to have compasses in certain tanks when they were going to cross the Rhine to get them exactly on the thing. So they had a what they call a projector binnacle, that's a compass that shot up in the air out of the top of the turret of the tank, so it wasn't affected by the magnetism. And they had a directional gyro in beside the driver, so the bearing was given to him, and he had to keep his tank, and the they were aquatic tanks, if you can understand, at that time. And he had to keep it dead on his, the number that came up in front of him, he had to keep that, and it would waver off to the right and left. And eventually they got on exactly on the spot they intended to do, irrespective of the high currents and everything like that. And that's what was doing the training on that. Then, after I'd finished those courses, I went on what they call the crew commanders course. They were teaching crew commanders. And all this time, they were getting ready for the invasion, for D-Day. And all around us was Americans. All, if you know down the Dorset coast, between Poole and Weymouth, there's a lot of rolling countryside and lots of little forests, little woods. And it's full of Americans. And the Germans used to come over every night, practically. I don't know, they never hit the gunnery school for some reason or other. And they used to drop what they call butterfly bombs into the woods where these Americans and some of our British chaps were there as well. And eventually, after a period of time, the wings of the butterfly bombs would close and they would drop down and explode into amongst these troops. And there was a lot of that went on there. And it was there then till the end of the war. But it was the most marvellous place. The people that were there, the special people, the Nat Kinella and his Georgian band were there, and at Bobington, and they played it. The dancers were wonderful. The Garrison Rec there. They had a chap called Roy Dolby. I think he's part of the Dolby family of the day. But he was a manager at Elstree Studios. And he used to get, when they had a dance, he used to bring down a setting of screens and decorations from Elstree to make it look what it was supposed to be. And of course we had a company of ATS girls there as well. So it was really considering you didn't have to go on the invasion, that it was heaven on earth. And that court continued then, and they took over a big area of land in East Lulworth and made a big long range there, 3,000 yard range into the hill. They had to evacuate a couple of villages, and that caused a bit of concern. People had to leave their villages that were in the overs part. And that's what I did there until the end of the war.
And you were an instructor on the crew commanders?
I was an instructor there.
So what did you do? Can you take me through a day of how you would instruct the recruits on the course?
First of all, the method of instruction, a lot of it. And they first of all, they had a lot of indoor areas, and they had, you know, in high these range bombings now, because the tanks were being used like artillery pieces, and you'd have three tanks and the representative models in this indoor place, and with the high explosive guns, the 75 millimetres, and there were later 90 millimetres, they used to have the main one would define the range, and inside you did the whole thing, but there was a chap underneath the frame with little puffs of smoke, and when it said such and such a place, a range, and he'd look on his squares and he's all underneath him, 2,000 such and such in the bearing, and fire, and the fella would say fire now, and he'd puff the smoke up. Now it had probably gone plus of the target, and he'd then have to bring back, and they used to what they call bracket. He'd bring it one minus of the target, then half that again, and eventually you hit the target. And when it came, he looked and he'd see it was exactly over the spot where it was marked. He'd put up a flare, and that was a sort of indoor puff range. Then there was outside, they were doing the same sort of thing with a pellet gun. Instead of, you operated the controls of the main gun, but outside, sitting on the front of the guns, was a chap, an instructor, who fired a pellet gun. So you aimed at the target, and you said, fire, and your trigger was coordinated with the pellet gun outside, and it would fire and hit the target. And the chap outside would load up the pellets again. And that was the sort of practical training then they got. Then there was quite a lot of indoor examination of different types of ammunition, things like that. Then they went out on the ranges. Well, you can understand the physical side of it, loading. It was all American ammunition, and it came in triangular boxes. You had the shells were about that size.
So what's that, about 2 foot long?
Yeah, about 18 inches to 2 foot. That's the cartridge, first, and the projectile, all in one piece. And then they were in cardboard containers, and a metal bracket at each side so that they wouldn't get damaged. Well, the amount of time they had spent loading and unloading these, and they then loading up the tanks, and then driving out to the firing range. If you're ever down at that part of Dorset, it's open to the public, and you can actually go on to the actual hard standings where the actual tanks lined up, and load them up, and then the main emphasis was on troop shooting. The individual shooting, you couldn't teach people very much about that, because it was up to the individuals and the situation. The tank commander saw, if he saw another enemy tank in front of him, he would be able to direct them. They did that on the pellet ranges. But out of doors, it was the troop shooting, that a troop of tanks could actually be coordinated. So the crew commander's tank at range, as I showed you, then bracketing, get onto the target, then he was able to pass the bearing and the A range to A and B tanks, and then he would give command for them to range, and then they'd open fire, the three of them. And you can just imagine, you get three lots of shells coming down onto an area, maybe of transport or troops or something like that, and that's what they was practicing doing that, and he'd just spend 12 hours a day doing that.
So that sounds like a development of the tactics you described when you were training in the desert.
Yeah.
It changed. Was there any other changes in the tactics that were employed?
Well, no, not really, because it was just because of enclosed country. The different thing is that you get in Europe all these hedges, and then an enemy tank or an enemy infantry could be very close to you. But on the desert, they really weren't. There was a reasonable chance that you could get away with it. But in Normandy and the beginning, then an awful lot of them got knocked out because the enemy were dug in very close, and they got very close to them before they observed them.
And what tanks were you using in the training?
Shermans, mostly Shermans. And they had another English Churchill. A Churchill tank came out. That was the British version of the Sherman, but they were mainly Sherman because the Americans were piling in loads and loads of them.
And what was your impression of using the Sherman after the Grant?
Oh, it was wonderful compared with, but the Grant was so limited in what you could do. You could only use it, and it was rather cumbersome and big. It, as I told you, it was rather higher, and it was presented a much bigger target, and they were left out in the Middle East anyhow. They weren't used in Europe.
Was there any other forms of training that you undertook with the on the crew course?
Not really, because the war had ended then, and we did. Then I had to go to Buckingham Palace to be decorated by the King.
Oh, can you tell me about that?
They set you up with a brand new uniform and everything, and it was went up to there into the main entrance, and there's an inner court there, and the varying medals, ranks I should say, other ranks in one place, officers in another, and we were in the 1855 suite. That was a suite that the Empress Eugenie of France had in 1855, and all the wonderful decorations and all were there, antiques and the portraits and everything, and we had to wait it there for a time, and then we were called down, and the King was there, and there was an admiral, a general, and an air marshal, and then there was another a secretary or an ADC, whatever you'd call them, they're a chancellor probably, and he read out the names. And before you went down, they put like a little coat hanger on a pin on your breast. And the reason for that was that over 50 or more years or 100 years before, Queen Victoria had pinned a medal straight through a chap's chest. And then they realised that that was wrong to do. So they had this little hook thing that they put on you. And the King, well, he just stuttered. He just couldn't say anything. He just, did you like it or something like that? And just pinned the medal on you, shook your hand, and went on to the next one. And
that was for your award of the MM, was it?
Yeah.
So that was at the end of the war?
Yeah, that was at, the war was over then. That's when you got presented. You see, some of the chaps didn't go to Buckingham Palace. I was one of the early ones and went to Buckingham Palace. But those chaps got presented by the generals in the field. But fortunately, you went there. But it's funny that at the time, I was over in Dublin and on leave. And got this letter from the Lord Chancellor. That's what the royal command. You are commanded to attend. You can have two visitors. And they had a royal command to attend. And I asked anybody in my family, they were really Republican minded, they wouldn't be seen dead there.
I was going to ask, what was the feelings of some members of your family that you were in the British forces during the Second World War?
Well, my mother's side was all right because she was, but my father's side were not. The Kennedys were country folk, farmers, and they were really basically Republicans. And it was amazing. They said this Uncle Patrick that I went to see one time, my brother Frank and I went down to see him. And he's speaking to him. I brought an album and shown the pictures, mainly of the Holy Land, that we're very interested in. And He said, I like a good Irishman and I like a good Englishman, but I don't like an Irishman that fights for England.
So what did you feel about that?
I knew he just up and left. So he was happy to be rid of us anyhow, I suppose. But anyhow, then I went over, they had an aunt who was a farmer's wife over at the Fen, and we were made welcome there because they were a bit more modern. But it was amazing that they was inbred into them. They just wanted it. But it's rather amusing.
So what was your reaction to the end of the war?
But the end of the war was terrific. The celebrations were absolutely marvellous. Oh, I didn't tell you how much. There was a D-Day, when D-Day came along at Lulworth, and we were all listening very carefully to it. And in the evening, we went down to have a drink, celebrate the invasion. There's two pubs in Lulworth Cove. One is out of bounds to other ranks, officers only. And the other one was for the town. And when we got there, it was about 7 o'clock in the evening, there were some American sailors there. And I won't say they're having the time of their life. And I said, where were they? And they spoke to us. He said, oh yeah, we were in a landing cab. We were over and landing. And they had one of these high-speed patrol boats. And he said, it's such a mix-up that nobody knew where they were going. And said, we've decided to come back. So they had their lovely patrol boat in Lulworth Cove, and they were in the pub drinking, and all their mates were in the war. It was amazing.
So what did you think about D-Day then?
Well, it was just a celebration, just a normal. The war was over as far as we were concerned. We were training. We just had the celebration for D-Day. But then we started to take our crew commander's course out onto Salisbury Plain, a part of Salisbury Plain, and they had to do long range driving and getting more used to the close country. And we did that, and they had to do a lot of convoy work at night, driving a column of tanks and a column of car lorries at night time, so that they got used to the separation, and they did quite a bit of that at night.
And the recruits, during that period you were there from in 1944 and 1945, the people that you were training, would they be then drafted regiments?
Yes, they were going out to their regiments, and they got the latest training, and they were going out. And an awful lot of them then were young men that were going to be young officers. And they did a training, and the Royal Armoured Corps, Octu, was at Bovington Camp, so they did a part of their gunnery training at Lulworth. And the people that were called up for the there was a very famous author, R.C. Shepherds. Have you ever heard of him? He was there, and his job was doing a cartoon every day. Dirty Dick and Lazy Lenny or something it was, and it was a cartoon that went up on the notice board for to take care of something. He'd have a dirty belt or something on, and they'd be making sure that you had your belt clean the next day. And Graham Sutherland, he was afterwards the conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. He was a sergeant there in the same mess as us. And there was a number of high quality people from the city, bankers and all. And even then, they were able to run the cars. They had permission. And at the weekends, if they weren't on training, they used to go off to London and come back then. The number of people from the various walks of life that had been called up and got these, what I'd call cushy numbers. And the place was saturated by them.
Did they know each other?
They mixed very well, and They were doing their job, of course, in the army. There was a lot of experimental sections. They tried to make anti-aircraft tanks, a tank with a turret with a vertical gun, and that caved in after a bit because the artillery really had all these anti-aircraft guns, and there was all these experimental from these floating tanks and all, a lot of that was done, the dry water part of it was done then. There was a lot of them employed in that sort of work, in experimental work. I suppose a lot of them had the necessary engineering talents and all there. But the entertainment side was terrific. And you had all these posh ENSA people come down. They were doing their stuff for the country. And you'd have various famous actresses and actors come and do a little show. And this chap was able to present the scenery for them. And another character that slept in the same room as me, you'd probably remember, Arthur English. Did you ever remember him, the comedian? He was the sergeant with me, and he was there. And he went down to be quite well known.
Was he a funny man then?
And he was a funny man. He used to do turns then, and they thought the world of him.
What type of turns did he used to do?
Just joking turns, and he could sing a bit, and... He was always rather smutty, as you can imagine, with troops, but he was very good, naturally was. Yeah. They were the people that were there. They were all funneled in for the use of their talents. And when a lot of the gunnery, the crew commander's course packed in, because everything was moving over to France and they were beginning to move towards Belgium and Germany, and... I got posted then to the OCTU, the Royal Armoured Corps Officers Training Unit. And that's the photo I showed you when Montgomery came to visit them. And I had the gunnery instructor's job there, teaching these cadets. And they were doing the basic training of gunnery, the very same as we'd been doing before. And of course, they were going to be young officers, and they would be crew commanders. So they had crew commanders courses, and they had all the same equipment at Bovington.
So it was the same course, but for the young officers?
For the young officers. And they were kept separate, of course, from the other rank. And that's where this chap in my class offered me a job in his father's estate, because I was going out of the army. I thought I'd pack in Earl Grosvenor. He said, my dad's got a big stately home up in Cheshire. He said, it's taken over by the army, but it is going to be handed back shortly. He said, I'll get you a job. You'd have to start as a junior footman, but you'd get on very rapidly.
Do you have any memories of VE Day?
It was sort of an anticlimax there, because the courses still went on. They celebrated, of course, and yeah. They enjoy this sort of holiday, and an interesting happened to me then. There was a church and a little military church at Bovington Camp, and one of the sergeants there who was leaving the army, they wanted somebody to help the priest. And being a Roman Catholic, and I used to go to the church the odd time, and he said, would you volunteer to help the priest down there? Because I've got to leave, I'm being demobbed. So I went and done that. So I used to serve as an adult at the mass at the church in Bovington Camp. And eventually I got demobbed for a while, and went up to Woking and went through all the process of being demobbed.
What was that process like?
It's quite interesting. It fitted you out with everything and the documents and all that you needed. And I only stayed out, you were allowed a year. And I stayed out and went home to Ireland for a bit and didn't like it all that much, and decided to rejoin. And I wrote to them, they welcomed me back with open arms. And I came back, went up to County Durham, and that was a reception place, Barnet Castle, and then I got posted to the 8th Royal Tank Regiment at Catrick Camp, and I became an instructor there, and they had all the national servicemen coming in. And the regiment then, after a year or so, was posted to Germany, and we all went off to Paderborn in Germany. And there we stayed, and I was at Germany, in the regiment of Germany, I was the troop sergeant in charge of our HQ, regimental headquarters, there. And all of, without even knowing it, they said, "You're being promoted. You made squadron quartermaster sergeant, and you've been promoted back to your old regiment, the 6th Royal Tank Regiment, which are down in Munster in Westphalia." And I went back down there, and I was a squadron quartermaster for quite a while, and then I got promoted to warrant officer, and I was the sergeant major of the squadron that I'd been a trooper in.
You went to Germany in 1948?
It's all down in the...
Yeah, 1948.
Yeah.
What was your impressions of Germany?
Oh, it was wonderful. Because I was newly married, and the conditions were absolutely excellent. We were in Paderborn, we were in a lovely German army barracks. It had all been set out for some of their panzer regiments. And the it was well equipped, and certain of the blocks had been taken over and converted into married quarters, and money was not spared anything. It was absolutely, furniture was absolutely wonderful, the kitchen facilities and everything were wonderful, and my wife, newly married, enjoyed it no end. And after a while then, as I say, I got sent back down to Munster in Westphalia, and we were there for until 1956, and then the sewers business came up.